Happy Thanksgiving, Bat fans, and welcome back to Batman Nightcast, a proud part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, covering classic and contemporary comic book adventures of the Dark Knight Detective and the Boy Wonder. I'm Ryan Daly.
And I'm Chris Franklin.
And this episode, we are continuing our coverage of the modern series, Batman and Robin Year One, while concluding the Clayface 3 story in Detective Comics 479, which also basically ended Marshall Rogers' run on the book.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, he did do that story in Detective number 481, which was right when Detective became merged with Batman family. But that's pretty much it. You know, he did the Midnight, Death Strikes at Midnight in three. Yeah, he did that in the Batman Spectacular. But I think that was 1978. So it might have, yeah, it was probably around the same time. I don't know which, but those are the last two Batman stories he did, I think. So, you know, for years, you know. So he, you know, my understanding is Marshall Rogers had, I think he had some drug problems back then. And I don't know if there were deadline issues or what was going on. I don't know that. I just know that he drifted away from the DC offices. I know he did some Marvel stuff, you know, starting in the 80s. I know he did some independent stuff as well, some early independent stuff. And some of it was Steve Englehart, you know, and we kind of lost him on Batman till he did the Secret Origins that we covered way, way back on your Secret Origins podcast and some Who's Who pages. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll obviously talk a little bit more about Rogers when we cover the first story. But before that, just in kind of a housekeeping Batman reading stuff, like what's going on lately in the Batman world, finally made it to a comic book store for the first time in a while, a couple of weeks ago. And I picked up the first two issues of the new Batman title by Matt Fraction and Jorge Jimenez. I liked it. I don't love the new redesign for Batman's costume with the blue bat signal shape. It's okay. I do think I was going to mention this later, but Jorge Jimenez, who has been on the Batman book for a number of years now, he's really, really good at capturing modern conventional Batman. He's one of the best to do that. So I like him, but I just, not crazy about this costume design. But it's an interesting story, and I like that. However, I also got the first trade paperback of Absolute Batman, the new series by Scott Snyder. And, oh, God, who's the artist on that one? East of West guy. I can't think of his name.
I can't think of his name.
And I can't reach my copy of the book either. Anyway, that artist. You know, I was hesitant. I was reluctant to go down the Absolute Batman things, and we had some words to say about that new design of him with that crazy bat symbol that doesn't look like a bat at all. Well, because it's more of an axe head than an actual bat symbol, which sounds preposterous. But I read the book, the trade, the first six issues, and I really like it. It's a very different take. So, you know, you have to go into this understanding. It's like, this is not your mom and dad's Bruce Wayne Batman, or rather your Bruce Wayne Batman. But it's good. Like this setting, I think the things they do work in a contemporary setting. He is not a billionaire. He doesn't come from money. His parents were kind of like middle, lower class. His dad was a teacher. You know, a big, spoiling this, but a big thing is that not both of his parents were murdered when he was a kid. One of them is still very much alive, but the incident that kind of created this thing in him wasn't just like witnessing this murder. It was like a mass shooting in a public place. So it was this larger kind of trauma thing that inflicted not just Bruce, but the city of Gotham in a way. And that feels very contemporary today and stuff like that. And he has a different socioeconomic background. His relationship to his rogues gallery is very different in this. And you see that right away. It's like, oh, these guys are not who we think they are. So there's just a lot of stuff going on, and it's good. It's total like what we would think of as an Elseworlds Batman. But if you kind of, if you look at it the way we looked at Elseworlds in the 90s, it's just an alternate take. It's really, really good. I'm enjoying it a lot.
I haven't read that, but everything everybody's told me, including my son Andrew, has said, yeah, give it a shot because, yeah, I mean, the art is very well done, but, you know, like the crazy proportions of Batman were pretty off-putting to me, honestly. But I've heard everything in the Absolute Universe is actually really good. Superman, Wonder Woman, The Flash, The Martian Manhunter is really weird, but in a good way. But I'm willing to give it a shot. I just haven't. I need to. Well, that's a whole other issue. I don't currently have DC Universe Infinite. You know a little bit about this, but
I know a little bit about that.
there was a snafu with that they sent. Oh, we're renewing your DC Universe. Great, it's automatic. Well, they had an old credit card on file. Because I had paid for it several years in a row or something, and I didn't realize that they didn't have our new credit card, and they didn't contact me and let me know. So now I don't have it, and now I've got to wait like so long before I get back on, or it won't let me do it, or it's really ridiculous. But anyway, yeah.
Listeners, that's not the story he told us at the Fire and Water Group. He said the credit card was declined because he bought too many blow molds.
That's possible too. That's very possible. But no, I want to give that a shot. I did read just tonight. I've had them, but I did read the first two issues of the new Batman series tonight because I knew you wanted to talk about it. I liked it. I liked it. This is the first new set in continuity Batman comic I've read in a long time. There were things about it that I'm like, wait a minute, Gordon's a beat cop. Vandal Savage is the commissioner. What? There's things like that. Obviously, very allegoric to our times, things going on in this comic. But, it's well done. I like Tim being Robin. I don't know why Tim doesn't know how to drive the Batmobile. He had his own freaking car, but other than that, okay, when he was 15, he had a special license to drive around his father, who was in a wheelchair. And that's how he had the Red Bird, right? So, I mean, it's like it's breaking my continuity brain somewhat, but all that aside, I enjoyed it, and I like the kind of setup of okay, now Batman and Robin are wanted by this corrupt police department. Yeah, obviously, again, it's a story of our times. and some people might not like that, but get over it. It's don't read it if you don't like it. But I shouldn't say get over it. Just don't read it. You don't have to get over it. Just don't read it because I don't like it when people say just get over it. So just don't read it. Yeah. But yeah, I liked it. I liked it. So yeah, I think it's off to a good start. I'm interested to see what happens as we move forward.
The previous run by Chip Zdarsky, which I really, really liked, and that was I didn't go all the way back to reading the whole Tom King run and the James Tynion run that followed that, but I went as far back as the Chip Zdarsky one because I really liked his work on other books, including Daredevil. So I read his Batman run, and I really, really liked that. And I think he did something really kind of unexpected, which he took a lot of the concepts that Grant Morrison played with in his time on Batman, with the whole the Zur-En-Arrh thing and a lot of the other like all these crazy things in Batman's like preparation and his backup personalities and all of these things that work when Grant Morrison plays with them, and then when everybody else looks at it, it's like this. I don't understand what you're doing, Grant Morrison. You're like this psychedelic wizard, and it's a magic trick that doesn't work for anybody else. Chip Zdarsky worked with that same stuff and found a way of making it cool and making it interesting and played with that. But one of the things he had to do was Batman died sort of while getting transported into like a parallel, an alternate dimension where there never was a Batman and the criminals are kind of running the city, and he has to, it's one of those where he's starting from the ground up. He has no money, he has no, and then eventually, because as you do, he comes back to our world. But during the time he was gone, he was declared legally dead and lost like all the fortune, everything was like seized and everything like that. And Wayne Manor went up for auction and Vandal Savage bought it. So now Vandal Savage had Wayne Manor and the Batcave and everything like that. So yeah, it was a rough coming home again and everything.
Okay, I was wondering about that. I didn't want to. I didn't. You know. I figure I'll have to do the research and catch up. But I didn't expect you or our listeners to fill me in. But I'm kind of interested to see where how he got there. But now I appreciate the fill in because I figured I knew he said he didn't. He tells Killer Croc he used to have one of those in his house when they're looking at the big dinosaur model. And it's like, oh, and they're at Pennyworth Manor. Yeah, so it's like, and Alfred's still dead. It's like, really, guys, come on, really, you couldn't have undone that. I mean, but we got hologram Alfred now, like I mentioned last time. So it's like, okay.
They've found non-permanent ways of bringing him back from time to time, of kind of playing with his character, even though he's not alive. But they do different things. The story arc where he is in this alternate universe, is called The Batman of Gotham, with like a hyphen in the Batman, The Batman of Gotham. And the climax of that story is Bruce kind of leaping, like doing like a quantum leap thing, going through all of these different dimensions to get back to our world. And it was I don't know what issue it was, but it must have been a milestone issue, because every page he's in a different world, but the art style changes. It's a different artist representing a different kind of era or thing of Batman, like a
Oh, I had
Frank.
that one. I bought
Oh,
that
okay.
one. I bought that. I did buy that one because he meets Adam West. He meets Michael Keaton.
All those,
That's cool. Yeah. Is he still missing a hand? Does he still have a robot hand, or did they fix that?
Yeah, no, I think he does. I think he still has a prosthetic or cybernetic hand on that one side. So,
Yeah,
I mean,
that's
he wears the
weird.
gloves, so it doesn't really matter, but.
Right, I guess, but it's like weird that it's like, okay, yeah. I mean, eventually somebody's going to hit the reset button on all this, so it's like, it's fine, but it's like, but like I said, I enjoyed it. I'm being open-minded. I liked it. I liked the art. I didn't dislike his costume as much as I thought I might. I don't hate it anyway, but it's like, it's not changed that much. It's just honestly just the way he draws it. It's kind of like when they made that big deal after No Man's Land, or like, this is what Batman's costume looks like now. It's like, well, it's essentially the new Batman Adventures look, which is like, but then other people didn't draw it that different, so it'll get watered down over time, and he'll just look like normal Batman again, probably. But yeah, like we said, I wish somebody would bring back the Oval, just because other than Batman Incorporated, they haven't done that in forever, so.
Well, when you say that, because since the last time we recorded, both this series, Batman and Robin Year One, have concluded, that run concluded with issue 12, but also the other Batman limited series that I've been really enjoying, Dark Patterns, also wrapped up. And that almost has the oval,
Yeah.
but Hayden Sherman draws it as a circle. And
Yeah.
it's one of those things, I was like, that's, you're almost there. I really like this. You're almost there. It's got the yellow background and the bat symbol. It looks classic. It looks how it was like Brad Sanders, but it's just the wrong shape. It's just too, like, you need to flatten that out. Squeeze the top and bottom of that.
Well, I mean, it really was more of a circle when the new look started. It kind of evolved into an oval. So, I guess it makes sense. Yeah.
But that series was really good. I enjoyed that. Batman Dark Patterns, written by Dan Waters. The art by Hayden Sherman, who's also the artist on Absolute Wonder Woman. And that's really cool. That feels like, I think I described it for you. Like, it kind of has the feel of a 90s, maybe Chuck Dixon era Batman story, with like, and it's broken up into three different arcs, but there is a running theme between them all. But yeah, I like that. It feels, it's, that's one that's like kind of set in its own little area. You don't have to be worry about any kind of contemporary, what's going on in the modern Batman books. It's its own thing, which is nice. And
Yeah,
the
I want to
other,
try that out in that first night, Batman First Night. I never have read the first one, and I know the second one's getting ready to wrap up. I need to try both of those series.
same. Hopefully, and these are some modern books that we can cover on the podcast eventually, maybe. But the other thing that you've got to read, and I know that you're going to ask Cindy for these for Christmas, but the two novels, by John Jackson Miller. And a while ago we talked about the first one, called Batman Resurrection, and it is a sequel to the Batman 1989 movie. It's in the Tim Burton world. He just released the second one, and I think this is it. It was called a duology, because this one comes pretty close to where we are in Batman Returns. The new one is called Batman Revolution, and they're both really good. I mean, he has a way of writing that you hear the voices of the actors in your head, like, and his grasp, like, Max Schreck has a pretty big part in Batman Revolution, and he just like gets them, like, to the point, like at one part where he's like, he actually does like the Schreck's line where he's like, "I am the light of the city and I am its mean twisted soul," and he has like this inner monologue thing. I'm like, man, this guy seems kind of psychotic. Was he like that in the movie? I was like, oh yeah, he pushed his secretary out a window. Yeah, he was psychotic. I was like,
Yeah, he was psychotic. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and he killed his partner too, because remember the Penguin had his arm in a bag, he pulled it out, and he's like, he's like, oh, he's on vacation or whatever, blah, blah, blah. It's extended vacation. And he's like, ah, here's your hand. He pulls it out of the bag and waves it at him. Yeah. So yeah, he was a
we
killer.
kind of see where that comes from. We get an
Oh,
indication
okay.
of like that whole, how that partnership ended. is informed in
Gotcha.
these books. Like Robert Wool's character Alexander Knox is a big part of it. Both of books, he gives an explanation for why Knox isn't in Batman Returns, and he doesn't kill him off, but he just comes up with a clever way of essentially Bruce Wayne gives him the grant that Alex asked for in the first movie. And he gives him this journalistic grant to
Nice.
basically travel to Metropolis and all these other cities and do like all these investigative journalistic things. And the reason he does that is because Knox has spent so much time next to both Bruce and Batman that he's like, he's gonna figure it out. He's like, I'm gonna slip up or something, and he's gonna
Yeah.
make the connection. I need to get him away from me. So it's kind of funny.
Nice. I like that. Yeah. I'm looking forward to reading those. I need to make sure that I put those, on my Christmas list.
And
Yeah.
there's, I'm not, I won't spoil it because it's too good, but there is a villain in the new one, Batman Revolution, who's like a secondary or tertiary villain. And the whole time you're like, okay, it's gotta be somebody from Batman's Rogues Gallery, because that's kind of what he's playing with and everything. But it's just, I don't recognize who this could be. It's something, or it's not, like, I'm just not getting it. And then he drops like one line where he essentially gives it up by like making this, I won't say it, but he tells you, and when he does, it's like, oh my God, he used that villain, and it's funny, but it's, yeah.
Captain Stingery. No, I'm just kidding.
There you go.
the spook. I don't know. well, speaking of Batman 89, I will say I saw something. This is very rare for me, but not that I'm like know every Batman toy ever made, but I've got a pretty good idea of ones made by the big manufacturers, at least in the US. I was at a toy show this weekend and I came across something that I couldn't pass up. It was a really good price. It was a two pack of die cast figures from Ertl. Ertl made all the die cast vehicles from Batman 89, that came out when the movie did. They made the Batwing, the Batmobile, the Joker van, all those things in different scales. And I have those. And they also made die cast figurines, just static figures. About 2.5 inches tall, something like that, too. Maybe about the size of a mask figure or something, they also did DC Comics versions too, but I just thought in the first, I never knew they made anybody but Batman from the first film. Well, this is a two pack with Batman and the Joker at that scale is a pretty nice likeness of Jack Nicholson. I mean, it looks like Jack Nicholson's Joker and you don't see that very often. He has, that didn't get licensed out very often. And apparently McFarlane's saying they're going to put one out that's kind of looks like Jack Nicholson because they can't quite get the license or they likeness rights or they can't afford it. But I was happy to find that. I was like, wow, it's something new from 1989 that I didn't know existed. So, and I got it for a good price. So I was real happy with it.
Awesome. I love that. That's so cool. All right, folks. I think we are going to take a short break to play a promo. And then when we come back, Chris is going to tell you a little something about Detective Comics issue 479. Stick around.
I'm scaling this wall just as easily as I can walk. My fingers alone are adhering, supporting me.
The Amazing Spider-Man, created by Stan Lee and Steve Ditko, has conquered every medium. From newspaper strips to the silver screen. But he began his life in a pulp periodical destined for cancellation. Let's explore these beginnings together. The Amazing Spider-Man from the very beginning. A brand new podcast on Spotify.
There's some sort of danger here, but what?
Okay, we're back, and now we're going to cover Detective Comics number 479, the swan song of Marshall Rogers, more or less, on this title. It was released June 27th, 1978, and the story was If a Man Be Made of Clay. The cover is by Rogers and Dick Giordano. Clayface 3 holds Batman aloft by the throat as the wax museum burns around them. I think this is a pretty cool cover. What do you think, Ryan?
I do as well. I like this one a lot. I didn't even realize it. I always kind of looked at it and just thought the background was a flat red, but that's actually the inside of his cape that they're doing red, sort of as a maybe kind of like lit up by the fire. And I think that's pretty cool. It's I'm a little confused why Hawkman is fighting Clayface too. That, oh no, wait, that's an insert panel. That's the other.
This is the DC explosion. This is the actual issue where DC explodes and then later implodes, which is why Detective almost got canceled after this issue. But yeah, so yeah, I always liked it. I like the red inside the cape because you don't see that very often. And I wouldn't want Batman's cape to be red like, some versions of Dracula, but
Right,
it
right.
looks cool here for a nice visual. And yeah, this is kind of my. This is one of my favorite Marshall Rogers covers, and definitely of the last of the three that we've covered here in the last 3 months, this is my favorite of the batch.
I don't know why it is. I just you really get more of a sense that he's wearing an opera cloak, which is kind of crazy over at top of his like technology and like tech-based like power suit and everything that's keeping him alive. So that's just a funny contrast, but I like that Batman has it like in his grip and the way his face looks in profile, the way Clayface's face. So
Yeah,
yeah.
it's really cool. Okay, so the story, as we said, is If a Man Be Made of Clay. Len Wein was the writer. Marshall Rogers and Dick Giordano were the illustrators. Ben Oda, the letterer. Marshall Rogers was also the colorist. And Julius Schwartz was the editor. Clayface 3 stands over the prone figure of Batman, telling him he regrets what he must do next. He ungloves his right hand and he prepares to unleash the fever inside him. Batman, remembering what happened to the security guard the night before, pulls an electrical wire that shocks the metal-encased monster. Batman kicks his assailant away and throws a smoke pellet, but finds his foe gone when the smoke clears. Hearing an engine, the Dark Knight races outside to find that his Batmobile has lost two wheels and Clayface has gotten away with the stolen device. The pain of his fever is too much to bear for Preston Payne, who loses control of his stolen car along a Gotham country road, resulting in a fiery crash. He cries for help from a passing motorist who attempts to run him down. Clayface stops the car and, feeling justified at the man's homicidal tendencies, reduces him to goo, much to the horror of his girlfriend. Clayface then steals their car and drives off. Elsewhere in a subplot we won't get into at this time, a mysterious raven-haired woman with a leopard print coat and a pet cat visits the Wayne Foundation looking for Bruce. Batman finds the burning car and the traumatized woman, who throws herself into the Caped Crusader's arms for comfort. But in her face, the Batman sees Silver St. Cloud, the love he's just lost. Down the road, Clayface stops for gas, and the attendant is spooked enough by his appearance to call the police. This leads to Commissioner Gordon blocking off the Gotham Narrows Bridge and Payne's fastest way to his lair. Payne bails out of the car that rams into the police cordon, but Batman is waiting for him. He jumps off the bridge into the harbor below. Clayface returns to Father Knickerbocker's Wax Museum and uses the completed equipment to prepare what he hopes is a cure, promising he'll be able to love his precious Helena soon. But Batman arrives, literally pulling the plug on his operation. An enraged Clayface attacks, and Helena and the candles around her are knocked over in the melee, driving him even further into madness. Batman manages to remove the power source from his armor, making him no stronger than a normal man. The masked manhunter overpowers and cuffs his enemy, and they are met outside by a Gotham cop who points out that the Wax Museum is now on fire. Payne screams for Helena and bursts his cuffs, running back into the blazing building as it collapses. Later, Batman and Gordon's hope of learning more about the mysterious killer is dashed when the rubble produces no body. So, what do you think of this, Ryan?
Well, before I get into my thoughts on the comic, as pertains to your synopsis, the Batmobile lost two wheels and Clayface got away. Mwah. Chef's kiss. I didn't want to interrupt you to laugh during the recording, but I was like, that was, yeah. You didn't see the big smile on my face when you read that part.
Well, tis the season almost, so.
Yeah.
Yeah. But what did you think of the story?
I like the story. I I mean, of this whole sort of Clayface. I mean, I guess we just got the tiny little bit of him 2 issues ago, but of the so it's really more of a two-parter. I like this as a capper, as a finale for a little bit. It's fun. It moves quickly. There's a couple of different action beats. Maybe it moves too quickly because Batman may gets to some places that we don't really know how he got there or why he got there, but
Yeah.
Batman is still kind of in this emotionally fragile state over Silver. We see a little bit more of that, but yeah, it's fun. This is a good showing for this villain.
I think so too. I think it starts out strong. I love the splash. We have a figure of Batman that's framing the action with his cape, which is cool. And that particular legend of Batman that, tells his backstory and the little bat logo, that is used in many issues of Batman going forward. And so that I remember that as a kid. That's kind of like That's what that looks like in my brain. I don't really know how long it ran, but I think it ran for at least a year or two like that. So it's locked into my brain because around this time, shortly after this, is when I really started buying, having comics bought for me on an almost monthly basis. So, yeah.
I love that first splash. I love the image of Batman using his cape as a frame for the circular panel. But for some reason, I kind of wish Batman wasn't in that panel. It kind of looks like two Batman on the page, but I know they're not the same panels. They're kind of different, but I don't know. For some reason, my mind is just saying like he could just frame the circle and that we could only see Clayface in that panel would be clever. I don't know, but yeah, it's
Yeah, I
cool.
see what you mean. We don't want another whole Max Allan Collins thing where the other guy dressed as Batman keeps coming back every issue, That's for sure. Yeah. I did like that, I went back and looked at the previous issue, and you do see that when Batman is knocked into that equipment, it's sparking behind him. So they establish Marshall Rogers establishes that, there is a electrical connection loose so Batman can use it to fry Clayface. So I like that. That's a good, nice setup. And then I love the interesting angle in the top panel of page three where Batman's kicking Clayface. You don't see Batman's face, you just see like the arc of his back and Clayface's boot, which we'll get into, but I there's a lot of feet in these stories. Was Marshall Rogers the Quentin Tarantino of his time? I don't know.
This was the height of Shag's Batman phase, clearly.
Yeah, right. That's right.
Before that, on the top panel of page two, when he goes, "Forgive me, my friend, but I only do what I must to survive." My friend?
Yeah.
I understand being regretful that you don't want to kill. This is a necessary evil, and it's for your survival. But it's like, hey, Batman, my friend, I hate to do this to you. It's like, okay, hey, you may be a little bit more chummy than you than now.
Yeah. He's very polite. We'll get into that, but Preston Payne is very polite and he doesn't like rudeness in people. We'll get to that too. It's and I goofed. It's his left hand he's going to melt Batman with. So my apologies, guys. It's his left hand. I looked at the panel again now, but
I love Batman shocking him on at the bottom of that page, and just like how you get like a two-tone silhouette of him kind of throwing his arms, but like his cape spread out, and is that a Zipitone effect behind it?
I think so.
Because I don't think Marshall Rogers could do an issue without Zipitone.
No, I don't think so either. Yeah, and it's all the zzz, all the z's and the yeah. It looks really good. Yeah, it's really effective. Yeah, and of course, like I said, the shot where he kicks him, and then we've got the smoke pellet with the Zipitone look, Batman in the shadows there. That's really nice. But yeah, he runs outside, and I mean, he is flipped the Batmobile over and like literally rip on the driver's side, rip both wheels off. So it's like, man, dang, that's impressive,
I can't decide if this makes Jason Todd boosting the bat tires better or worse.
last guy who did this, his face was melting off,
Like on the one hand, like, oh yeah, there's a precedent for, somebody sneaking up to the Batmobile and getting rid of the tires and everything. On the other hand, it's like, okay, if a supervillain did this, a little kid can do it, and then, but there's all like, Batman, didn't you learn anything? Shouldn't you have known better?
Put it in the armadillo mode like Michael Keaton's got, right? With the armor, I mean,
Exactly.
come on, Yeah, I really like the next page where how Rogers illustrates the pain that Preston is in by, it's almost looks like Daredevil's radar sense, but it's like it keeps getting bigger. And in that last panel, you can see his skull inside the silhouette of his hood, from the side. It's like, I'm like, does he still have a skull? I guess he does. He's not like Matt Hagen. He can't shapeshift. He's just melting all the time, right? So we see the car come up and, he gets away from the fiery crash. The car comes up. We've got this guy, partying. He's got a party hat on and a noisemaker in his hand, and he's driving a Porsche, looks like, or Porsche, I guess. But yeah, the bottom of page six, when he stops the car, Rogers illustrates how much force he's using to stop this car by showing four close-ups of his feet that keep getting closer and closer of his boots. So
Feet, feet, feet.
feet, feet, feet. Yeah, again, you're right. Shag's gonna love this. Yeah. So
And then the driver, first of all, he's calling Clayface a road hog because, you know, he's standing in the road while, you know, he's trying to get to wherever he's going with the lady, their hot date, their next party. And then after he hits Clayface and Clayface stops the car, he gets out. He's like, okay, Buster, what's the big idea? Get your crumb mitts off of this car. I'm like, you know, for a drunk driver that just committed a crash onto a pedestrian, this guy has kind of a bad attitude.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of don't feel bad that he gets melted. I mean, yeah, he was just going to run somebody over because they were in his way, this Lester guy. Yeah. So, but I think, you know, of course, he melts him. And but, you know, the girl runs out screaming. And he says, please, my dear, there is no need for you to scream. The fever is no longer upon me. And she screams, I should have known better. Everyone I meet recoils from my touch. Even when I mean it to be tender, even when I mean it to be kind, you just melted her boyfriend. But he's like, you know, I'm being nice to you. Why are you being so rude? Basically, this is why he calls Batman friend. He's probably the most polite villain in Batman's rogues gallery. I think he could teach etiquette classes at Arkham. You know, why not? You know. Then we get the one-page subplot, which, why is Bruce's secretary working that late? I know it says she's working late, but, I mean, that is extremely late. I'm sorry. But, this mysterious dark-haired figure in a leopard print, which, if this is who we think it is, I don't think it's not an actual leopard fur, because I don't think she'd be down for that. And she's got a pet cat.
Right.
So, but, yeah, this is a big setup for Ween, because he's the first guy that really goes there. Well, it's Catwoman, guys. Okay, it's Selina Kyle. It's Catwoman. He's the first guy in Earth One continuity that actually starts a real romance between these two.
Mm-hmm.
It was a thing when I was first starting to read Batman. So yeah, it's pretty interesting. And it's I've actually got the Len Wein, the Tales of the Batman. Len Wein hardcover I'm looking at here, and I've read all those, and it's a good storyline. This is a great run of Batman anyway. I mean, I know it's not as celebrated as, you know, the Englehart Rogers run and the Neil Adams stories and things like that, but it is a good, solid Batman run. So I recommend you find this book and read it. It's really good. Or go to DC Universe Infinite if they haven't, you know, canceled your subscription or whatever, you know.
You're not bitter.
Yeah, I'm not bitter at all. Batman, we find out, I like the little bit that Batman says when he overturned the Batmobile, Clayface also damaged the collapsible whirly bat in its trunk. I managed to jury-rig the copter so it would fly, but it looks like I picked up the trail too late. So it, you know, at least, now that part, Ween covers. how Batman got there with no Batmobile. He'll forget to cover something in a little bit that we'll get to.
Yeah.
but I wish we could have seen the whirly bat, but we didn't. But so this is when, Batman comforts the girl who just saw Lester get melted. And, he sees Silver. And I like how Rogers illustrates that. You can see Silver's, you know, pulled back hair kind of over top of hers. But Batman, you know, loses it in front of her, and he's saying it out loud, so this poor girl must be really traumatized. Even the hero is nuts. You know?
That was my note. I was like, I think this dialogue should have been in a thought balloon, not a word balloon.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he just turns his back to this girl, blast it, no, I've got to gain control of myself. Silver is gone, I've lost her, and somehow I've got to accept that fact before I crack. It's like, okay, if I'm that girl, I'm like, you know what, I'm just going to walk back to Gotham, you do your own thing. Like,
yeah. I'm leaving.
Too many crazy men in my life.
Yeah, I'm leaving the city, I'm never coming back, yeah. So. Right. Then we get the little interlude with Clayface stopping for gas. I mean, that's something, you know, supervillains got to stop for gas, too. I mean, it's going to run, you know, and I can't help but this gas attendant, Sal Minkin, because of the time and what his hair and the ball cap, it's like, I feel like this is Jerry Reed. I feel like this is Jerry Reed from Smokey and the Bandit right here.
Mm-hmm.
Your face, what's wrong with your face?
Yeah.
You know, just saw there's some melted face guy down here at this gas station, you know.
Now, I gotta figure if, if Clayface is in this desperate to kind of get back to his lair and escape and everything, and he's got a, he this device that he stole. So to stop at the gas station, the tank has got to be like on empty, almost bone dry at this point. So you got to assume that Jerry Reed filled it up to the top, and he says that'll be 850. Wow, 850 to fill up an entire car tank of gas. I'm like, wow,
Yep,
remember that?
it was the
I think I put in $47 yesterday.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, crazy. Then I wonder, did Christopher Nolan read this story? Because he's going to cross the Gotham's Narrows Bridge. And in Batman Begins, what was that whole
Yeah,
thing?
I caught that too.
Yeah, section, the Narrows, that's the whole.
That island, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, that's where that came from. I wonder if Lin Wein got a check. They were giving out a lot of checks when those Nolan movies came out. So hopefully he got one. I don't know. But he rams the car into the blockade and rolls out, and he's climbing up the bridge. But there's Batman, and I love how he says, "Wherever I turn, whatever I do, I seem to find you there. Why in God's name do you keep haunting me, Batman? Why? Why?" And Batman just answers, "Because it's my job." It's like, I love that. It's like, yeah.
This was kind of the most obvious question and answer. It's like, why does Batman keep chasing me? Like, because you keep killing people.
Yeah.
That's your thing and that's his thing. It's like, this is a natural predator-prey relationship guy.
Exactly. Yeah. Now he jumps off the bridge into the harbor, and then we're back at the Father Knickerbocker Wax Museum. Helen is there, and he's just about ready to, have his cure ready, and Batman pulls the plug. And that's cool, but the problem is, how did Batman know where he was?
I was thinking about this, and my no prize is just the simplest, most obvious explanation. He followed him.
Yeah, he
Even
just.
if that means he jumped into the water after him, or just watched the shore waiting for somebody to climb out there and everything. And just like, he just kept his eyes open. He's like, oh, there he is. He climbed up on the shore on the pier or something over there. And he just followed him. Like, that's the only thing I can figure.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny that we don't have a line that, that he's like, I mean, he apparently was still in the Whirly Bat, so he could have followed him from the air and he might not have noticed, he could see somebody swimming below, and although I think he would have had to shine a spotlight on him to see him in the harbor at night. But yeah, it's just usually, there's usually like he put a tracer on him or he found something from the wax museum that he left behind, or there's always some clue because this guy's is Detective Comics, but it's you know it, yeah he just he Batman just shows up because he's got to stop him. So but yeah, I guess we'll no prize it that way. It's just it wasn't it's very rare for Lin Wein to not set something up like this, but we all make mistakes, so it's okay. I mean, it doesn't really harm anything. It was going to show up anyway, but yeah. So I think it's interesting. This reminds me, I didn't really think about this. There's an episode of a Batman animated series called Mudslide, which to me is kind of infamous because that's the one where Clayface is literally, Matt Hagen, is literally like he's falling apart. He like can't keep himself together. And this scientist that was a big fan of his movie career like tries to help him, and she's just about to cure him when Batman shows up and shuts everything down rather than let her cure him so he won't, one, die, and two, be an unstoppable monster. He can just arrest him after he's cured. But Batman pulls the plug on it, and for all intents and purposes, Clayface seemingly dies in that episode. He comes back later, but it's like Batman's a real. It's Bat Dickery at its finest in that episode. It's like the most dick move Batman made in the DCAU, I think. It really is. And it's kind of like that here, but I don't think Batman knows exactly what he's doing. He doesn't, I don't think Batman's for sure what he's trying to do with the equipment he's gathered, because he doesn't know anything about him. He doesn't know his backstory, or he obviously knows his face is messed up and he's melting, but you know, he's got something wrong with him because he keeps burning people, but he doesn't really know. So we can, you know, him pulling the plug on it here makes a little more sense, but I do wonder if that didn't influence that episode, this story.
Could be. I always love that episode too. That's one, like, I mean, I was sure that Clayface was dead the way they set that one up, and obviously he does come back in the next iteration of the animated series that came after that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I like that one. I remember that episode almost for its music. The musical sting at the end, when he's falling into the water.
Mm-hmm.
I just remember like this haunting, like, musical note that I just thought was really pretty and really dramatic in that one. For some reason, like, I mean, I always noticed the music in that cartoon, but that episode in particular, I liked. Yeah, and to bet what Batman is doing here, I guess, like, when in doubt, just stop the villain from achieving his evil plan, whatever it is. And then it's like, oh yeah, if I had known better, I might have let you save yourself. But you didn't tell me. You didn't say what you were doing. You just went around killing people. So
right. You know. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
After he depowers him, he's like, I do know that without the power of your stainless steel muscles, you're no stronger than any ordinary man. And no ordinary man is a match for me. All right, Batman, just a little full of yourself. You know?
Yeah.
Oh, let's just put it this way. A real badass doesn't tell people he's a badass.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. What happened to the strong, silent type there? You know, it's like, yeah, he's like, I'm an above Olympic level athlete, you know, it's just like, you know, according to my Who's Who page, you know. It's yeah. I like how he takes the power supply and whacks him with it, though. That's a nice
thing. Yes. Yeah.
And I do like that we see the candles as he's, you know, cuffing him and taking him away. We do see the candles that, you know, because Helena gets knocked over the mannequin, which Batman never really says much about the mannequin, you know, that he's, until the end, he kind of comments on it. But, yeah, it's starting to set the tablecloth on fire. So that's what starts the fire. So, yeah. That we get outside and the cop says, oh, you look, it's on, the museum's on fire. And I love that last panel on page 16 of Clayface's, you know, exaggerated face with his mouth like insanely wide open as he's screaming, you know,
Oh,
my precious Helena's inside. Mm-hmm. And you know, he of course snaps the cuffs and runs, and it says, you know, Batman thinks about going after him for a second, and then the whole thing just collapses. But it's, you know, Batman says he's gone completely off the deep end. But, you know, Clayface is in love with a mannequin, but Batman keeps seeing Silver's face everywhere. So, there's a little parallels there. Just saying. What if Batman had seen Silver's face in the mannequin of Helena? Then they would have fought over her. Well, maybe. I don't know. There's a wrinkle.
Yeah. I think who edited this? Was it Julie Schwartz or whoever?
Yeah, Julie Schwartz was the editor.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think he would have called Len Wein into his office and said, no, you can't have Batman in love with a mannequin.
No, let's not go that crazy with it. Yeah, I like that Batman and Gordon really don't know anything about Clayface here, which I didn't go back and read. I guess the next appearance of Clayface 3 is actually, isn't it actually the Alan Moore story in the annual? I think it is. And it seems like
I think so, which...
Yeah, Batman, yeah. I think, knows his backstory by then, but I don't know how he found out, but I don't know. So he is a detective, so, you know, maybe he figured it all out. So, you know... It's an exciting ending. I like this story overall. I think it's a really, really strong. The art's fantastic. The story's good. I never noticed that Batman just kind of magically happens to find him at the Wax Museum with no clues pointing there. But, you know, maybe you're right. Maybe he just simply followed him. So,
because this is likely the last Marshall Rogers one we'll talk about, we'll cover, I had to ask... and I think we've talked about this before, but things changed so often and it was so long ago. Like, like, where does Marshall Rogers rank in your list, your pantheon of Batman artists, or your Mount Rushmore, if you wanted to do a top four?
Well, yeah, this is hard, but I think my personal Mount Rushmore would be Dick Sprang, Neil mm-hmm. Adams, Marshall Rogers, and Bruce Timm. Because I think each of those, like, I know Sprang was basically basing his off the you know, Bob Kane model, but he elevated that. He's the best of those that drew that version of Batman.
Right.
You know, Adams brought that whole, you know, more photorealistic illustrative aspect to Batman. And Jim Aparo, I love Jim Aparo, but he kind of, you know, was teeing off what Adams had done. And, you know, even Garcia Lopez and people like that are still kind of teeing off what Adams has done. Rogers, there's a little bit of Adams in his early stuff, but he kind of quickly figured out his own take on Batman, I think. I feel like his Batman's pretty unique. And then there's guys mm-hmm. like Don Newton, who I love too, you know. But, and then Bruce mm-hmm. Timm, that was a, you know, just a huge leap. And then, you know, where's Norm Breyfogle? I don't know, but Rogers, I think Rogers is up there. He's up in the top for me. He's at least probably top, well, he's top three probably for me of all time Batman artists. So, yeah, nice. I just love his stuff. I'd love to see an actual, you know, we've had all these figures of different artists. I'd love to see a straight up Marshall Rogers Batman. The Joker that the DC Universe Classics released is a Marshall Rogers Joker. That's his Joker face.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd love to see them do somebody, McFarlane, or if Mattel gets the license back, make a Marshall Rogers Batman with a cloth cape. It's gotta have the cloth cape with yep. the wires in it.
With and the everything. Wired cape, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I'd love to see just that big cloak he gave Batman done, and with the thick ears he gives him and everything. Yeah, I'd love it.
Yeah, I end up making a long list too, and I wanted to shout out the like four modern Batman artists, just because I think like we spent so much time, you know, talking about the comics we loved as a child and the finding your joy and the nostalgia aspect of this particular hobby. I think we get very locked in, and it's hard for us to judge contemporary writers and artists and hold them up to the same level of favoritism as the ones that shaped us in our youth. So,
sure.
But I did want to mention like the current or recent Batman artists, like Greg Capullo, who worked with Scott Snyder on the New 52. Greg Capullo is an awesome Batman artist and did it for a while. Mm-hmm. The current one, Jorge Jimenez, Dan Mora, who we loved during his, you know, the Batman and Superman World's Finest. Dan Mora was awesome.
Yep.
And Chris Samnee, who we're going to talk about, Chris Samnee is kind of a descendant of both Bruce Timm and another one who surprised me in that he made my Mount Rushmore, my top four, which is Darwin Cook, who I think kind of like is a descendant sort of Bruce Timm in that kind of same style.
Yeah.
And what really did it for me was I can't think of anybody else to draw the Golden Age Batman better than Darwin Cook for me.
Yeah.
Like the way he makes it look with the different shape of the ears where they kind of flare out a little bit and the head is almost a little bit more triangular in shape and stuff like that. And,
yeah.
and the narrowness of it, and the way Darwin Cook drew that type of Batman in those early years, the little bit more of the Golden Age. I think the Amazon Batman series,
the Cape Crusader, Batman Cape Crusader.
Yeah. Yeah. Batman the Cape Crusader. Like I think that Batman, I think feels to me like it was informed a little bit by Darwin Cook's portrayal of that type of Batman character. So,
I would have, he worked on the animated series, you know, as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would have Neil Adams in the top four. Yeah. Kind of course, Jim Aparo would be up there. And I think the other one would be Norm Breyfogle, just because of how much I loved him as a kid, and like what he meant to me as a young formative comic book reader. I reread some of his stuff recently, and he does have some tics and some quirks that I don't like in his storytelling, some things that remind me a bit too much of other 90s artists that I constantly disparage. He did fall into some of those a few times, but his single panels, his covers, the way when he did like painted covers and painted Batman images, I really like what he did with those. I would have Marshall Rogers near the top four, David Mazzucchelli, if he did more on Batman, Mazzucchelli might be up there. I love me some Gene Colan. He's not my favorite Batman though. Yeah, Don Newton, like, you know, we could keep talking about every artist, like Alex Toth, if we want to. Steve
Oh,
Rude. Steve Rude is a good
yeah,
Batman.
he does. That's what I, when you said that about Darwin Cook, I feel like there's a little bit of Steve Rude's Batman and Darwin Cook's Batman. I feel like there's a little
Yeah,
bit
I
in
think
there.
so. I think you're right.
That World's Finest series that Steve Rude did with Dave Gibbons wrote that, right? Yeah, Dave Gibbons
I
wrote
think,
it.
yeah,
He
yeah, I think.
that's a, I mean, it's kind of a very quiet, small story. I think that's one reason why it doesn't get toted around like some of the others, but that's a good like 3-issue series. That's really, and the Superman's very Joe Shuster, and the Batman's very Bob Kane-ish, and Golden Age Batman. And he wanted to do it even more so, but I think DC made him pull back from that design a little bit. But yeah, it's that's sharp. Yeah, I'm with you. All these the modern guys you're talking about. The only reason I didn't really put any of them because I feel like. I can say these guys, it's been long enough. I can say, okay, they deserve to be on here. With the modern guys, I need to kind of, well, give them a couple years and then I'll, say, well, maybe they, but yeah, there's a lot of, there's a lot of guys that, that did Batman, that I liked Graham Nolan when he was doing Detective with Chuck Dixon. I mean, he's not like a superstar guy, but I really liked his solid Batman. It kind of reminded me a little bit of Don Newton, a little more cartoony in some ways, but it had that kind of solid anatomy that of a Don Newton, that kind of look. So yeah.
I, as you know, I talked to Kelly Jones, the artist, and I got
Yeah.
to mention that, and he a very, very distinct Batman, and certainly doesn't work for all occasions. Like you have to sort of be in the right world for Kelly Jones's Batman, but it's so distinct. I
Yeah.
dig that when it's when you're in that type of world.
Yeah.
So
I always liked this
gosh, you're
Batman.
making
Yeah.
yeah, you're making me rethink. Like I might need to parse mine out a little bit more and relook at that Steve Rude thing, because I sort of I tossed that name off, but I was like, maybe my Darwin Cook love is really Steve Rude. Steve Rude, like maybe I need to look at those clues. Like, how is it really the Steve Rude? Should he be up on the top four? But I don't know.
He hasn't done that much Batman, but when he does, I dig it. Yeah, it's good. Yeah, I like his Superman too, real well. He's done more Superman, but yeah. Yeah.
Alrighty, folks. We're going to take another promo break, and then when we come back, Batman and Robin, Year One, Issue 3. Don't go away.
It's Fade Out. Hosted by film fanatic Rob Kelly and a roster of special guests, Fade Out will examine the final films of Hollywood's brightest lights, part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
All right. Batman and Robin, Year One, Issue 3, titled Chapter 3, came out on December 18th, 2024. The plot was by both Mark Waid and Chris Samnee. Mark Waid wrote it, Chris Samnee drew it. Giovanna Nero was the colorist, and the letters were done by Clayton Cowles with Chris Samnee, and it was edited by Andrew Marino and Rob Levin. General Grimaldi orchestrates several attacks on the other Gotham crime families. Each attack, though, turns the families against each other, not Grimaldi, because the man he uses to set them up has the astonishing ability to look just like well-known members of the Falcone, Maroni, and Gotso mobs. Batman can't understand why the families would wreck the fragile stability of organized crime in Gotham all of a sudden without provocation, which is why he suspects they're being manipulated by the mysterious new boss that Two-Face alluded to back in issue one. And that sentence was way too long for me to read. Batman is so consumed by this situation that he, as Bruce Wayne, has neglected Dick Grayson for days. Alfred is finally able to get Bruce's attention, which he then directs to the boy's misbehavior when unsupervised. Bruce is forced to recognize that while he and Dick were both orphaned by violence, they are not as alike as he thought, and raising a child like that won't be as easy as he assumed. But Batman isn't the only one who figures someone else is pitting the mobs against each other. The dynamic duo sneak aboard a cargo barge miles off the coast of Gotham, where Alfonso Falcone and his goons have captured Two-Face. They torture him until he gives up Grimaldi's name. But that's not the only name he drops. Two-Face says he personally okayed the Zuko's hit on Haley's circus and the murder of Dick's parents. Hearing this sets Robin off before Batman can stop him. He vaults over the Falcone thugs to get to Two-Face. Batman drops smoke bombs on the gangsters to cover them as he hastily reveals to Robin that Two-Face was lying. In the ensuing chaos, most of the Falcones flee. Two-Face escapes and releases the ballast tanks, flooding the ship. Robin tries to stop Two-Face from escaping but isn't quick enough. As the ship begins to list, the giant cargo containers start to topple. Robin's leg is caught in a loose cable and he's nearly dragged over the side of the ship. Batman saves him, but can't save himself when a container knocks him overboard. Robin screams for the Dark Knight as he's pulled down into the sea. First up, the cover for this one, I didn't mention before, a cover where we're in the Batcave, we're behind the Batcomputer looking at Batman. He's got his hood off. He's just Bruce staring at the Batman computers with his hands kind of folded deep in thought. And Robin is just kind of kicking it bored in the background. Just like, looks like he's holding the battering, like he's going to throw it for practice or something. Just waiting for Batman to do something.
Yeah.
What do you think about the cover?
I like it. It's a cute cover. It's kind of interesting, like that the, you know, Robin's on one side and the doorway up to the stairwell up to the, I guess the grandfather clock's on the other side. And I like the whole metal rail thing. That's very Batman 89 that,
yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. It looks like the Toy Biz Bat Cave, you know,
I was going to say that was the first part of the toy that I lost.
Yeah. That's a good Bat Cave. That's probably the best thing they put in that line was that Bat Cave. Yeah. Honestly.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I really like it. I like that Robin's just kind of like ho-humming while Batman's doing all the, you know, he's pondering, you know, so it's cute. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The first couple pages, we get like the first 6 or 7 pages or so are just dedicated to these various hits. We see Grimaldi is organizing all these hits against the Falcones, the Maronis, the Gatzos. And in each case, the guy, Grimaldi's man, kind of orchestrating this whole thing, we don't see a full change. We just see from panel to panel, he looks like he's able to assume a different identity. Now, for Bat fans, it shouldn't be too difficult to figure out who this is, especially since we saw at the end of the last issue, the guy's face seemed to be melting. We've talked about this guy recently. Hint, but
it's false face. No, I'm just kidding.
It should have been false face.
That'd been awesome.
Or Professor Payne.
Yeah, Professor.
What did you think of the first couple pages of that whole intro?
I liked it. It's very, you know, I like the way that. That Samney, you know, that Wade and Samney break it down, that you see, like you said, you don't see him change, but you just see from panel to panel that the structure of the guy's face changes. You know, it's very obvious. You know, we talked about there were a couple things in the first two issues that were a little hard to follow. This is not. We know exactly, you know, it's like, because we know now that Clayface is going on. And I mean, I like that they shoot the guy in the leg through the door, just so he can, you know, see that he's Carlo Falcone, you know.
Yep.
That's a nice bit. And then, you know, there's Benny Gazzo. It's really well done. I really like, and I like the fact that we get, you know, we get like the days that at the top of the panel, like, you know, on Wednesday, he sent him to do, Grimaldi's telling him this is what we're going to do. And then Friday, this is what we're going to do. And we see his father, his invalid father there again.
Mm-hmm.
So that's setting, keeping that in the foreground. So that's interesting. We'll see where that goes. But yeah, I really think this is, it's a great, you know, crime noir. Feels very, you know, we're talking about David Mazzucchelli. This is very Batman Year One. Looks, you know, very, very of that world. So, yeah.
No need to be too clever about it. We're talking about Clayface here. Yeah. I just wanna, like
Matt Hagen.
And what I really like about this, what I appreciate, is that Mark Waid, he reins the character in, at least for now, because I think at this point, most of us who have been reading or exposed to Batman media, our image of Clayface is probably the animated series version or something like that. It's just hulking mud monster that's kind of oversized and overstrong. I'm like, the way he's not just like a he can assume other identities, but he's just more of like almost Plastic Man-esque in his ability to just change his shapes and form all these things. And I like that we're really going back to like, no, what is like the most bare bones, almost Batman 66 false face type of thing? Is just, what if this guy can just change his physical face to look like anybody else? How would he exploit that for his own riches? And the mob finds a way of using him to kind of set people up in this manipulation thing. And it's like, it's a great idea for a spy. It's like, you can all do these things for any of these kind of intrigue things. And which, as preposterous as it sounded, getting Clayface's own movie or TV show or whatever a few years ago, it's like, you know what? They can do a lot of really cool stuff with Clayface, depending on what angle they take with them. So
yeah,
yeah.
And this is kind of like the introduction of Clayface in Batman the Animated Series, because Roland Daggett had him, you know, disguise himself
impersonating as Bruce Wayne
yeah. and stuff. Yeah, yeah. In that, before he became the full on, you know, mud right. monster. Yeah, yeah. Right. So
then we go to the Batcave, and three pages of Bruce Wayne describing the situation and why it makes no sense for these mobs to target each other, and the fragile framework of the organized crime. And he's like, how it's as taut as piano wire, and why are they messing with this up? There's no gain from this. Who benefits? And as he's going through this whole thing, Alfred's just, sir, Master Bruce, sir. Yes, but yeah, sir, Master Bruce. Hey, Bruce. And he just like yeah. keeps it like for three pages until finally Alfred shouts.
Yeah.
He does it. He's like, the boy, Master Bruce, we have to talk about the boy. And you see Bruce kind of like, you've never raised your voice to me. He's like, I don't like it. But you wouldn't have done it without a good reason. He's like,
yeah. It's interesting because it's like he never raised his voice to Bruce in all the years that he, like, you know, before his parents died, and then when he raised him, you know, it's interesting. It's like Bruce, part of Bruce still thinks of Alfred as the butler in some ways, mm-hmm. which, you know, I think that's, you know, is that arrested development? Is that, you know, being born with a silver spoon in your mouth? I don't know, but it's like, you know. I think that's, yeah, but I like the fact that he's like, you know, it must have been really important for you to do that, you know, because it's like, you know, it's like, oh, you know better than to yell at me, you know, it must be something really, it's like, oh, really, Bruce? Wow. But yeah, poor Alfred, you know, he's so mm-hmm. frustrated. And it, for Alfred to lose his cool like he does on that page, where I love the panel mm-hmm. that's all the vertical lines behind him as he, you know, mm-hmm. yells that. That's great.
Yeah. And you're right, like in the ways Bruce thinks of him as a butler. And I think we are so used to kind of thinking of Batman or thinking of Alfred as the surrogate father for this family, not just Bruce, but especially for the different Robins, because Batman, you know, Bruce being so busy and always fighting crime, like in a very real sense, Alfred raised these kids and shaped them when they weren't out fighting crime. So we kind of thinking of him in this paternal sense, but at this point, at least in the sort of continuity, he doesn't have that relationship with all of these kids and this whole thing. And you're right, he is still very much, he's Bruce's employee and he's working for him and he's doing these things. And he's like, and at this point he's like, hey, you didn't hire me to take care of this child. That's your thing. You've got to do this. Mm-hmm. And he basically, he's like, he's like, yes, if I may. And he goes to the door. He's like, Mr. Pennyworth lodges a complaint, a play in one act. And he tries to open the door and it's like jammed shut because it's clogged by all of this stuff. And Dick Grayson is sitting there on the couch with junk food and snacks, laughing. He's doing a blah-ha-ha laugh.
Yep.
as he's watching what looks similar to a Mickey Mouse type of cartoon, but he seems to be doing a circus acrobat routine.
Yep.
And this, I love this art because Dick isn't even looking at the door, isn't even like acknowledging Alfred's existence, just walks up, closes the door, and locks it as he's still just watching the TV. It's so dismissive. It's so rude. And it's like, oh, yeah, this... forgive the language, this shitty little kid, adolescent punk. And it's like, yeah, we do need a kid has an attitude adjustment coming, that we need to fix something.
Yeah, yeah.
And Alfred, yeah, he says, he's like, you are responsible for this, not I. And please fix this.
I love it. Yeah, it's great. Yeah, the dynamic between Bruce and Alfred is really great in this, and I really like their conversation. You know that Bruce just assumed that Dick would respond to his traumatic event like he did, and he's not. So no. It's throwing him for a
He's like, because they were both shaped by the murder of their parents, but your backgrounds are nothing alike. And the great moment, he's like, Bruce is like, I don't understand, are all boys his age like this? And Alfred's, I wouldn't know, you were born at 25 years old.
I do like that we see a portrait of Thomas and Martha and Bruce is smiling, and then we see a portrait of Alfred and Bruce is not smiling.
Right.
I thought that's telling. Yeah. But, yeah, exactly. And I gotta say, I like that, as a parent, and I mean, you'll probably, if you haven't already figured this out, as your kids get older, you will, like, they do not respond to things the same way you did, even if you told them how you responded to things.
Right.
They really don't. and sometimes it's really frustrating and heartbreaking, and it can be really, it's like, well, I just assumed you'd do the same thing I did, and then you didn't, and now we're here where we're at, and it can be a wake-up call. So, and Bruce is, again, he's somewhat arrested developed man-child in some ways himself, so so here he is trying to raise another orphan, and he's obviously leaning on Alfred too much. Although, like you said, eventually Alfred will take on that responsibility because he has to fill that void. Because Bruce doesn't, he's busy either being Bruce Wayne or Batman. It's a really well done sequence, and it's just as interesting as all the General Grimaldi and the action stuff in this one for me. It's like a Steve Ditko, Stan Lee, Spider-Man comic. The Peter Parker stuff is actually more interesting than the supervillain stuff.
Oh, yeah. And part of it is, I mean, we've seen Batman and Robin kick bad guys' asses for years. It's like, we haven't seen the scenes like this all that often.
Right.
Or told from this kind of avenue, this perspective. So this is the meat. This is the characters that you love. It's not just the action. It's the character that you keep coming back to. So these are the moments that I really do love.
Yep.
Okay. However.
I like him that he calls him a tornado in sweatpants.
And then we do get to it, because Batman and Robin sneak aboard this ocean barge, this cargo freighter out at sea, and they're jumping around and they're sneaking around the rafters down in the ship's hold. And Alfonso Falcone has Two-Face tied up, and he's like, "Yeah, we knew that you were framing Carlo for this, or we know that." Carlo isn't the guy who hit the Gatso map of the Moronis or something, because Carlo was with me that night or something like that. So he's like, so something is going on. What's going on? So.
Yeah, I like that. It's like that's something Grimaldi didn't think about, that they'd actually, two of them would be together to verify that, So, I mean, rumors are still going to spread, and you're still going to have, it's going to be hard to squash that. Which is why they're meeting and why they've grabbed Two-Face to figure out what's going on. But I like that there's, even as Grimaldi's precision plan, it has a flaw. So I like that.
Right. And Alfonso is going to flip Harvey's coin to decide whether or not they torture him for the information or not. And they flip it, and you see the look on Batman and Robin's faces as they're watching this coin flip. And they're concerned. They're like, oh God. They're like, you can tell it's like they hope this goes easy for Harvey.
Right.
And then of course it lands clean side up, and Alfonso's like, damn. Well, I helped beat him anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
and I love the panel of Robin wincing as, whack pow, thump. Yeah.
That concern for Harvey is about to change.
Yes.
In the next one, he mentions how it's like nobody operates in Gotham without paying the dent tax. Like there are nothing happens without his say-so. He's the guy who okays everything. And he says, He's the one who let the Zuccos roll through Gotham last night so they could kill the circus couple.
Yeah.
And that's all. Robin is just off the pipe and everything and leaping into action, kicking guys in the face already.
Yeah. It's a very Jason Todd response. Honestly. Yeah, and it wouldn't take a whole lot for Two-Face to figure out that Dick Grayson is Robin from this, and who just adopted Dick Grayson, you know?
Yeah, for real.
Who took that boy in, or maybe didn't officially adopt him, but So, yeah, I was waiting for him to start hitting Harvey and saying, "This is for my mother, my father, that brother I never had. You know, this is for me."
He tips over Harvey's chair and everything, and he's like shouting at him, calling him a monster and everything like that. And you just see on either side of Robin the puffs of like smoke bombs going off as Batman is like, "Oh God, I gotta save this kid from himself." He's like, "All right, I gotta clean up this mess."
And I like it. He says, "Wow, kid, you'll believe anything." You know, so I'm just like, you know, it's like even Two-Face is like admitting it. You know, he's like, "I just told him
Yeah. Batman's like, "He was bluffing." And then Two-Face seems to stomp Alfonso on his way out of there.
Ooh. You reckon he killed him, or did he just like jack his face up real bad? I don't know. It's
good question. Either way, I think he left him to drown. So
yeah, that's true. Yeah, it's all right. Yeah.
It's interesting though that like Batman throws the smoke bombs to cover Dick and him, but then it's like Batman almost loses the sense of where Two-Face and everybody else is in his own smoke. It's kind of like it's like you would think he would have some kind of precaution for that, so he himself doesn't get confused by his own, you know, smoke bombs. But
Yeah, that's something you don't see very often. It's like he can somehow always sees through it and knows where everything's at while, you know. But although I guess in the previous story, Clayface 3 got away when he threw the smoke pellets too, so kind of happened two stories in a row.
True. And then the ship starts to list to one side. We see all the cargo crates coming off her shoulder, which is a really cool scene. I just, you know, Sammy's drawing of this whole action piece is, I really, really love it.
Yeah.
And we get this moment where like you see Dick is even starting to panic, like he's lost his direction. He's like, "What side of the boat are we on?" He's confused. He's screwed up a couple of times now because he let Harvey get away after blowing it. Really, I think he's like so much in his head that he's not aware of his surroundings, and he nearly gets pulled overboard by when the cable wraps around his foot. For being as competent as Dick is, he's still a child. He's still capable of messing up. He still has that, you know, rookie learning curve. But in this case, when Batman has to save him, it nearly costs Batman his life, so.
Yeah, it's you know, like if Batman Begins tells everything anything, you got to be aware of your surroundings, you know. So I do love that all the panels after Harvey opens the ballasts, all the panels are angled. Like you get
Yes.
the weight of the boat sliding is in the page, you know. It's like
Yeah.
it's
Yeah,
a
yeah, yeah.
great effect. I mean, you can just feel it. Feels very topsy-turvy. It feels like
Yep.
you're angling off the ship yourself, you know.
Right.
It's like you
Right,
can,
you're kind of swaying to the side as you're imbalanced.
if you've got a weak stomach, this could make you seasick reading it, you know. Yeah, it's a heck of a cliffhanger. I mean, Batman, you know, going off, you know, with this humongous crate, you know, crushing him under the sea. I mean, I don't, you know, I've read this before, but I haven't read ahead again. I'm like, ooh, I'm looking forward to seeing how he gets out of this. So.
No, he doesn't. He dies.
Oh,
This is the
okay.
last time we see Batman. Yeah. Any other thoughts, Bob?
No, I think this is, you know, again, it's another great chapter. As much as, you know, like I said, the Grimaldi storyline and having Two-Face and all the crime families is great. That's, you know, that's the noirish stuff that we're looking for in this type of Batman story. But the character development, the storyline of Bruce, Dick, and Alfred is the meat and potatoes here that really satisfies.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. All right. Well, folks, that's going to be it for this one. We are going to continue this trend of doing something old, something new. We're going to pick up Batman and Robin Year 1, Issue 4 in January. with another comic beside it. But next month, we should see you, or you should hear from us on Christmas Day, I think. And for that one, it's going to be a little bit different. We're going to cover one issue, a Christmas story of some kind, with a new guest that hasn't been on the show before. And then after that one, Chris and I are also going to respond to the listener feedback from the last three or four episodes before this. So that'll be our Christmas episode and our listener feedback episode. So yeah, really looking forward to that.
Yep. So if you've got a feedback that you haven't written us about the previous ones or this episode or any of them, just be sure to leave it with this, you know, leave it and we'll get to it and we'll comment on air and we'll get to, you know, read you'll get to hear your name read out loud on Fat Man Nightcast, your dream, your Christmas wish come true.
And given the kind of the discussion we were having, you know, I mean, like, share with us your lists of your favorite Batman artists. It can be a Mount Rushmore. It can be a top, you know, a top 50. Those are your only options, either just four or just 50. which modern artists do you really like? Which contemporary Batman artist would you follow?
Yeah. I thought that'd be interesting to hear that because, you know, it's like, yeah, it's going to be. Batman is kind of the ultimate of the main big comic heroes that is so, you know, open to artistic interpretation. I think that's one reason why he's always been so popular. So there's so many different takes on him. It'll be interesting to hear what, you know, people's favorites are beyond the obvious. But even the obvious ones, I'm you know, I'd like to hear what you like about Neil Adams, Jim Aparo, you know, those guys. So, yeah, that'd be great.
Alrighty, folks, till next time, Batman Nightcast is a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Feedback for the show can be left at fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can also find Batman Nightcast and the Fire and Water Network on Facebook, Blue Sky, and other social media platforms.
If you enjoyed this episode, please check out our Patreon at patreon.com/FWPodcast to support Batman Nightcast or your other favorite shows on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
As always, thank you for listening. You're out on the town, safe from the crowd.